I want you to do something for a second. Just imagine reaching into your pocket or, your purse and pulling out your wallet.
Yeah, or grabbing your phone if you just use Apple Pay or whatever.
Right, exactly. So open it up, look at the paper money inside, or just think about the plastic cards, those digits on a screen. Usually, when we interact with that money, we view it purely as a utility, right? Like it's completely functional. It's how you buy your morning coffee, it's how you pay rent.
Yeah, it feels like a completely neutral tool, like a ruler or a thermometer or something, just a unit of measurement for getting through your day.
Right. But what if it isn't neutral at all? What if that money sitting in your wallet right now is actually the invisible architecture dictating whether the world around us is at peace or at war?
It's a heavy thought.
It really is. What if the very mathematical design of our money, like the actual mechanics of how it's issued and how it circulates, what if that structurally enforces global conflict and, endless resource extraction?
And extreme inequality. It is profoundly unsettling when you actually dig into it,
Yeah.
because we are so conditioned from birth to just accept the economy as this, I mean, this unchangeable law of physics.
Like gravity.
Exactly, like gravity. You don't question gravity.
Wow.
But the stack of sources we are analyzing today reveals something entirely different. They argue that the economy is a design choice.
Yeah.
And the current design, what these authors call the political fiat money regime, is fundamentally extractive. It literally requires perpetual expansion just to survive.
And historically, perpetual expansion means perpetual conflict.
It always has.
So that is our mission for this deep dive. We are going to deconstruct this current political fiat money regime because our sources argue that it's not just inherently unfair, but it's actually highly unstable, like structurally brittle.
Super brittle.
Right. And once we take apart the engine of this current system to see why it's failing, we're going to look at the blueprints for a meticulously designed alternative.
Yeah, a proposed honest exchange system.
Exactly. An honest exchange system that could theoretically pull us back from the brink of a massive economic shock.
And it is an incredibly ambitious blueprint. I mean, to really grasp it, we have to examine the intersection of money, data, and global power. So we are pulling from a deeply interconnected stack of materials today. We've got historical civilizational analysis from Professor Carol Quigley.
We've got structural theories from Ashkin Hossein Zyada on the weaponization of the US dollar.
Right. And then some really explosive geopolitical forecasting from Yanis Varoufakis about the acute vulnerability of the modern neoliberal economy.
Yeah, the shock vulnerability stuff from Varoufakis is wild. And we're also looking at the literal mechanical blueprints for a totally new kind of digital token currency from Thomas H. Greco Jr., alongside concepts for, democratizing civic data.
It's a massive stack.
It is. Now, before we get into the mechanics of empires and honest money, I just want to give a quick heads up to you listening.
Yeah, this is important.
Right. The sources we're diving into today have some incredibly sharp, highly politically charged critiques. They take aim at global leaders, the American political establishment, various international conflicts, and they span perspectives from the left all the way to the right.
They hit everybody.
They really do. So you want to be absolutely clear here. We aren't here to take sides, and we are not endorsing any of the specific political viewpoints or historical judgments contained in these texts.
Right.
Our sole purpose today is to impartially report on the arguments exactly as the authors presented them so you can see how the math and the architecture of these proposed systems actually work.
Yeah, we're just looking at the blueprints.
Yeah.
And with that context established, if we want to figure out how to build a better system, we first have to understand the invisible architecture of the one we currently live inside.
The fiat empire.
Exactly. We need to look at the structural realities of the fiat empire.
Let's start with this massive paradox that Hossein Zyada points out regarding U.S. monetary hegemony. Because back in 1960, the United States accounted for roughly 40% of the entire world's GDP.
Right, an absolute titan.
An undisputed economic titan, yeah. Manufacturing a huge portion of the world's physical goods. But today, that number has dropped to near 24%.
Which is a very significant relative decline.
Yeah.
I mean, the U.S. simply does not make as much of the world's physical stuff anymore.
Right. But here is the paradox. Despite that shrinking share of the global pie, the US dollar still accounts for over 58% of all global foreign exchange reserves. And even wilder, it is involved in a staggering 88% of all foreign exchange transactions worldwide.
88%. It's crazy.
It is. If a country's share of global production is shrinking that much, how on earth does it maintain such an absolute stranglehold on the world's money?
Well, That is the core question Hoseinzadeh answers. He argues that in the modern era, global dominance isn't just about how many physical goods you produce. It's about something called asymmetric network centrality.
Okay, I'm going to need you to unpack asymmetric network centrality, because that sounds like, I don't know, a term from a graduate-level computer science seminar.
It essentially is a network science concept, yeah.
Yeah.
Think of the global financial system not as this totally free open market where everyone trades equally, but as a really rigid hub-and-spoke network.
Okay.
Imagine a bicycle wheel. Most countries and their domestic banks, they're out on the rim of the wheel, right? At the end of the spokes.
Got it.
But the hub, the center where all those spokes physically converge, that is controlled by a few massive money center banks, primarily located in places like New York.
So if a business in Brazil wants to buy machinery from a manufacturer in Japan, their banks don't just hand the money over directly to each other.
Rarely. I mean, because neither the Brazilian real nor the Japanese yen is universally accepted everywhere, they almost always use the U.S. dollar as a vehicle currency.
Because it's the most liquid.
Exactly. And that means the transaction, mechanically speaking, has to be routed through correspondent banking accounts at those central hub banks in New York. The U.S. literally sits at the very center of the global plumbing.
And Hoseinzadeh points out that sitting at the center of the plumbing gives the U.S. two massive distinct powers over the rest of the world.
Yeah.
He calls them the panopticon and the choke point.
Right.
And I think the clearest way to understand this is to look at SWIFT.
SWIFT is the perfect mechanical example.
Yeah.
So SWIFT is the global messaging network that banks use to securely send payment instructions to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It processes over 40 million messages a day. We're talking about trillions of dollars moving based on these secure messages. And because the U.S. and its close allies have dominant influence over these central routing nodes, it acts as a panopticon.
Like a watchtower in a prison.
Exactly. They can see the financial flows of the entire world. They can track who is buying what, where the money is going, who is doing business with whom. It is an unparalleled surveillance power.
But surveillance is only half of it, right? Because the other power is the choke point, the exclusion power.
Yeah, that's the scary part.
Right. Because if you're a sovereign nation or even just a massive multinational business and you get cut off from SWIFT or cut off from those New York correspondent banks,
you're done.
You are essentially exiled from the modern global economy. You can't clear transactions, you can't buy oil, you can't sell exports.
And this network centrality, it's deeply reinforced by a rigid monetary hierarchy. And at the very top of this hierarchy isn't actually the paper dollar, it's the U.S. Treasury bond.
The ultimate safe asset. Hoseinzadeh notes there's over $25 trillion of it outstanding.
Yeah. And this creates an incredibly powerful feedback loop. Because everyone in the world needs to hold dollars to facilitate trade.
Right.
So they need a safe place to store those dollars. So they earn a little interest. So they buy U.S. Treasuries. That massive global demand makes the Treasury market incredibly deep and liquid.
Meaning you can buy or sell $1 billion of treasuries in seconds without moving the price.
Exactly. And because it's so liquid, it attracts even more demand from central banks and corporations. It just locks everyone in. It's a structural trap.
Which has led to a major evolution in how geopolitics actually works today. Hoseinzadeh calls it weaponized interdependence.
Hmm.
Because the U.S. controls the central hub, they don't necessarily need to use, you know, broad, clumsy military embargoes or blockade ports with ships anymore.
No, they can just engage in systemic financial warfare.
Right. They can drop a country from SWIFT with a few keystrokes. They can freeze the central bank reserves of sovereign nations, completely crippling their economies overnight without firing a single shot.
It is an incredibly potent tool of statecraft.
It's like the global financial system is this massive, unavoidable highway. And right in the middle of it is a combined panopticon and toll booth.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, like every nation, every business has to drive through it.
Yeah.
The operator in the watchtower can see exactly what's in your trunk, where you are going, who you're doing business with.
Mm-hmm.
And if the operator decides they don't like your politics or your actions, they just drop the toll gate and say, you can't drive here anymore. You are stranded.
Right.
But wait. If you weaponize that toll booth too often and you keep dropping the gate on people, won't the rest of the world eventually realize it's a trap and just start building a new highway?
They absolutely will.
Yeah.
And that is exactly the long-term vulnerability Hoseinzadeh identifies. When you weaponize the system, you give your geopolitical rivals an existential incentive to bypass it.
Which we're seeing right now.
Exactly. See it happening right now with efforts to build alternative payment systems outside the dollar network, you know, settling trade in local currencies. But building a new global financial highway takes decades. The more immediate danger, like the really terrifying vulnerability our sources point out, is what happens when that massive centralized toll booth is hit by a real-world geopolitical earthquake.
And what would that earthquake look like? This is where the explosive analysis from Yiannis Varoufakis comes in.
Yes.
Because he argues that this entire system, this U.S. neoliberal economic model built on the fiat dollar, is actually walking dead. Like, it looks invincible because of the hub-and-spoke control, but it is structurally incredibly brittle.
Yeah, Varoufakis contends that the U.S. economy has undergone this fatal structural shift over the last few decades. It transitioned away from actually manufacturing things from real, tangible production and shifted heavily toward financialization and rent extraction.
Okay, let me make sure I understand what financialization actually means in this context, mechanically speaking. Because, you know, we hear that buzzword a whole lot.
Sure. Mechanically, it means the engine of the economy shifted from Main Street to Wall Street. Instead of generating wealth by building factories, inventing new physical technologies, selling goods, the economy generates profit by moving money around, packaging debt, charging interest, and extracting fees or rent from existing assets.
Right. So the financial sector becomes the dominant force rather than the productive sector.
Exactly.
And according to his interview in our source stack, this financialized empire only survives because it is propped up by three very specific, very fragile pillars.
Mm-hmm.
First, access to cheap global energy to keep the underlying physical logistics moving. Second, unquestioned global trust in the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. And third, the military and geopolitical ability to enforce that financial hegemony globally.
And Varoufakis proposes a specific stress test to see how brittle this really is. He outlines a scenario of a major conflict in the Middle East, specifically a U.S.-Iran war.
Okay.
He argues this scenario wouldn't just be a localized military quagmire. It would be the exact structural shock that shatters all three of those pillars simultaneously.
Yeah, the math he lays out regarding modern asymmetric warfare is just wild. We aren't fighting in the 20th century anymore. He points out the complete absurdity of the current technological balance.
Yeah, the drone stuff.
Right. You have a $5,000 drone, basically something you could build with commercial parts. And it is capable of destroying or depleting a $1.6 million Patriot missile.
The economic asymmetry there is staggering. I mean, power is decentralizing technologically.
Mm.
Think about the math of a sustained conflict there.
Okay.
If your enemy is sending swarms of cheap $5,000 drones, and you have to fire a $1.6 million interceptor missile to stop each one, you will literally bankrupt your empire trying to shoot down cheap plastic with high-end tech.
Endless imperial wars become mathematically ruinous.
Exactly.
And if that conflict escalates, Varoufakis points straight to the geopolitical jugular, the Strait of Hormuz. Because a massive percentage of the world's daily oil supply flows through that narrow waterway. If a conflict disrupts that strait, you trigger a global energy shock of historic proportions.
And this is where we have to trace the exact mechanical failure mode of the fiat system step by step, as Varoufakis outlines it. Because it isn't just that oil gets expensive, it's how the fiat architecture reacts to it.
Okay, walk me through it.
So, step one, the oil shock hits. The strait is blocked, and the price of energy skyrockets overnight.
Okay, so step two is generalized systemic inflation, right?
Right.
Because our fiat money is completely decoupled from real production, like, it isn't anchored to anything tangible. There's no shock absorber.
Not at all.
The sudden jump in energy costs instantly bleeds into the price of literally everything else. If you're an Amazon delivery driver, the cost of gas for your van doubles. So Amazon raises shipping prices.
Mm.
The manufacturer paying for that shipping raises the price of the goods. Everything just spirals.
Which forces step three? The central banks, specifically the Federal Reserve, really only have one blunt instrument to fight runaway systemic inflation.
Jacking up interest rates.
Exactly. They have to make borrowing money incredibly expensive to cool down the economy and destroy demand.
But here is the fatal flaw. Step four. They are jacking up interest rates on a system that is entirely built on astronomical compounding debt.
Yeah, that's the killer.
Right. From the national government running trillion-dollar deficits, down to the corporations surviving on rolling debt, down to the average consumer living on credit cards, the fiat system requires constant cheap borrowing to function.
So when interest rates spike rapidly to fight the inflation, the cost of servicing that ocean of debt just explodes.
Oh, wow.
You trigger a massive leverage cascade. Highly leveraged businesses can't roll over their debt, so they default. This causes a panic in the bond market. Asset prices crash.
The collateral just vanishes.
The collateral backing the entire financialized system evaporates.
Yeah.
And the debt-based house of cards comes crashing down.
So the system literally cannot absorb a real-world supply shock because it has optimized for financial returns and rent extraction rather than real-world physical resilience.
Exactly. And in that chaotic collapse, the dollar loses its aura of invincibility, which accelerates the push by other nations to abandon that centralized toll booth we talked about earlier.
And Varoufakis goes so far as to speculate on what happens after this collapse. He warns that unless we intentionally redesign the monetary system now, we are heading for a new dark age he calls techno-feudalism.
Techno-feudalism.
Yeah. What does that actually look like for the average person?
It's a highly fragmented world where the old neoliberal free market order is dead, replaced by a system ruled by massive tech monopolies and state capital alliances.
Okay.
Instead of free citizens operating in open markets, we essentially become digital serfs.
Serfs? Wow.
Yeah. We work, we socialize, and transact entirely on platforms owned by a few megacorporations, paying them a portion of our value just for the privilege of existing in their digital fiefdoms.
That is incredibly bleak. But, you know, I find myself asking, how did we get here?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is our money designed as a debt-based house of cards in the first place? To understand why this system is leading us toward this collapse, we have to zoom out from the current geopolitical chessboard. We need to look at the macro level of human history.
And this is where Professor Carol Quigley's historical framework becomes absolutely essential. Quigley was a legendary historian, and his sweeping thesis is that civilizations rise and fall based on the health of something he calls their instrument of expansion.
An instrument of expansion? What exactly is that?
Quigley argues that for any civilization to grow and thrive, it must have a systemic mechanism, an instrument that accomplishes three specific things.
Okay.
First, it must create an economic surplus.
Yeah.
Meaning the society produces more food, energy, or goods than it strictly needs to survive the winter.
Right.
Second, it must concentrate that surplus into the hands of a specific group or institution. Mm-hmm. And third, and most crucially, it must incentivize that group to invest the surplus back into new innovations, new infrastructure, and expanded societal capacity.
So when a civilization is young and vibrant, this instrument of expansion is working perfectly.
Right.
The surplus is being created, concentrated, and heavily reinvested. Society flourishes. But Quigley identifies what the instrument of expansion is for our modern Western era. It is credit, financial capitalism.
Exactly. The ability to issue credit became the primary engine of the modern world.
And the historical precedent he uses to illustrate the birth of this era is fascinating. We have to go back to the founding of the Bank of England in 1694.
Yeah, this is key.
Because this isn't just dry financial history. This is the moment the DNA of our current system was coded. So set the scene for us.
Okay, so it's the late 17th century. King William III of England is locked in a brutal, exhausting war with France. The English government is essentially broke. The credit of the crown is ruined. They desperately need money to build ships and pay soldiers, but they have exhausted their ability to tax the populace directly without sparking a full-on revolt.
So a group of private financiers, essentially wealthy goldsmiths and merchants, approach the government and propose a radical deal.
Mm-hmm.
They offer to loan the government a massive sum of gold, like 1.2 million pounds, but in exchange, they don't just want regular interest. They want the government to grant them a royal charter to form the Bank of England with the unprecedented exclusive privilege to issue paper money banknotes against that government debt.
And this is a monumental shift. They essentially monetized the state's debt.
Wow.
They were granted the privilege to create the very means of exchange out of thin air, backed entirely by the promise of the government's future taxation.
So the king gets his war funds immediately.
Right, and the bankers get to print paper money that the whole country is forced to use, collecting interest on it.
Quigley contrasts this brilliantly with Napoleon over a century later, because Napoleon fundamentally distrusted this Anglo system of paper credit and state debt.
He hated it.
He believed it was a house of cards. He wanted to rely on sound money backed by actual gold and the real productive capacity of French agriculture and manufacturing. But he was ultimately defeated. Why?
Because England's ability to weaponize debt simply overwhelmed Napoleon's sound money approach. England could print fiat credit to fund endless military campaigns, subsidize massive coalitions of allies, and sustain a war machine far beyond its actual physical present-day means.
Ah. So the Bank of England model proved so militarily dominant that it became the mandatory blueprint for the entire globe.
Exactly. Every major nation realized that if they didn't adopt central banking and fiat credit, they would just be conquered by someone who did.
Right.
But Quigley's framework contains a dark, inevitable warning. Over time, an instrument of expansion always enters a decay phase. It transforms into what he calls a vested interest.
A vested interest?
Yeah. A vested interest means the institution stops serving the growth of society. The elite group that controls the instrument, in our case, the financial sector, stops investing the surplus into productive, real-world innovations.
Right. They just hoard it.
Exactly. They use their control of the instrument to defend their own entrenched power, to stifle competition, and to extract wealth from the rest of the population. Credit stops being a tool for societal growth and becomes an instrument of pure extraction.
Think about what this means for you listening to this right now. Why should you care about a theory of civilizational decay and a bank founded in 1694?
Mm-hmm.
Because it dictates the reality you live in today.
Yeah.
When a government can simply print fiat credit to fund a multi-trillion-dollar war on the other side of the planet or to bail out failing megabanks, it doesn't need to ask your permission.
If a government had to explicitly raise your income taxes by 30% today to fund a foreign conflict, what would happen?
The public would revolt.
Exactly. The public would immediately demand an end to the war. They'd look at their paychecks and say, "We are broke. Stop the machine."
But fiat credit hides the cost. The cost of the war, the cost of maintaining the empire, isn't on your tax bill. It is hidden in systemic inflation and a ballooning national debt.
Yeah.
It quietly siphons the purchasing power out of the money sitting in your wallet. Your groceries double in price. Your rent skyrockets. It completely removes the public's ability to pull the emergency brake on the imperial machine because the extraction is invisible.
Which brings us to a critical crossroads in our analysis.
Mm.
If weaponized fiat credit is driving civilizational decay, extracting wealth from the working class, and setting us up for the catastrophic, brittle collapse that Varoufakis describes, what do we do?
Right. Are we just doomed to collapse into techno-feudalism?
No. And this is where the source material pivots from diagnosing the disease to proposing an incredibly detailed mechanical cure.
Yes.
How do we build an instrument of expansion that actually works for everyone, one that isn't built on compounding debt?
So we turn to the work of Thomas H. Greco Jr. and his concept of an honest exchange system. But to understand Greco's blueprint, we have to completely unlearn what we think money actually is.
Yeah. We are so deeply conditioned to think of money as a thing like a commodity, a physical piece of gold, or a specific paper dollar bill that has intrinsic value in and of itself.
Right.
But Greco argues that money fundamentally is not a commodity. It is a memory technology for trust.
A memory technology for trust. Okay, so before big cities and global trade, if you lived in a small village of 50 people, you didn't need money.
No.
You just needed a good memory. The baker gave the blacksmith a loaf of bread and remembered that the blacksmith owed him a favor, maybe fixing a plow later. Trust was direct, relational, and based on mutual survival.
Mm-hmm.
But when societies grew too large for everyone to know each other personally, we needed a technology to record that trust across strangers.
Exactly. Money in its purest, most honest form is simply frozen trust. It is an accounting voucher. Greco explains that true money has two types of backing. When a seller accepts money in exchange for their physical goods or labor, they are providing the material backing for that money. They are giving it real-world value.
Right.
And when a buyer pledges to accept that money back in the future for their own goods, they are providing the moral backing.
Okay, so if money is just a decentralized ledger of trust, I have to bring up the elephant in the room.
The crypto question.
Yes, because whenever we talk about escaping central banks, escaping fiat inflation, everyone immediately points to crypto. Bitcoin fixes this. Doesn't cryptocurrency solve this exact problem of state monopoly?
It's a very common assumption, and you know, it seems intuitive at first. But Greco's sources provide a razor-sharp mechanical critique of why crypto, as it is currently designed, fundamentally fails as an actual currency.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He categorizes Bitcoin and similar cryptos not as money, but as virtual digital commodities.
I want to make sure I grasp the distinction there, because a commodity is something like gold or oil. It has a price that fluctuates based on supply and demand.
Right.
Crypto is built entirely on the concept of artificial scarcity. Bitcoin is hard capped at 21 million coins. The whole point is that it is designed to be deflationary, meaning as demand grows, but supply stays fixed, the value of the coin goes up compared to fiat.
Right. And while that might make it an interesting speculative investment, Greco points out that deflationary assets actively destroy currency circulation.
Because they encourage hoarding.
Exactly. Or what the crypto community proudly calls HODLing.
Right. If you are hoarding your tokens because you're convinced they'll make you a millionaire next year, you aren't going to use them to buy groceries today.
No.
Which reminds me of the most famous and honestly, arguably most tragic story in crypto history. Mm-hmm. Back in 2010, a guy bought two Papa John's pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin.
Yep, pizza guy.
Today, that Bitcoin would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. People mercilessly mock him on the internet now.
But Greco's point is that the pizza guy was actually doing the right thing.
Wait, really?
Yeah. He was trying to use it as money. He was trying to facilitate an exchange of real goods. The fact that the entire culture learned from his quote-unquote mistake to never ever spend their Bitcoin is exactly why the system fails as a currency. If everyone hoards the tokens, commerce stops.
Mm.
The baker can't buy flour. The carpenter can't buy wood. The economy grinds to an absolute halt. Money must move to be useful.
So an honest currency must be tied to the actual fluid production of goods and services available in the market, not to speculative digital scarcity.
Exactly.
And to prove this isn't just utopian academic theory, Greco points to a phenomenal historical precedent.
Yeah.
We need to talk about the Swiss WIR Bank.
The WIR Bank is a perfect historical case study. So the year is 1934. The Great Depression is ravaging Europe. Official fiat money has essentially vanished from circulation. The banks are completely frozen, credit is entirely dry, businesses are collapsing left and right. But they aren't collapsing because they don't have goods or because people don't want to work. They are collapsing purely because there is no money to facilitate the trade. The medium of exchange is broken.
The baker still has an oven full of bread. The carpenter still has chairs to sell. The townspeople are hungry and need furniture. The real wealth is there, but the tickets to move it are missing.
In response to this paralysis, a group of small and medium enterprises, SMEs, in Switzerland, did something truly radical.
Mm-hmm.
They realized they didn't need the central bank's fiat money to trade with each other. They just needed a reliable accounting system to record their mutual trust. So they created their own mutual credit clearing network.
Walk me through exactly how that worked on a Tuesday morning in 1934.
Sure. If the carpenter needs bread, he goes to the baker. He doesn't have Swiss francs. But both are members of the WIR network. The carpenter buys the bread, and his account on the shared ledger is debited by a certain amount of WIR credits. The baker's account is credited by the exact same amount.
Wait, so no actual paper money changes hands?
None. The entire system is based entirely on the trust that the carpenter will eventually produce real value, like a chair, to balance his negative account.
So they completely bypassed the frozen central banks.
Mm-hmm.
They created their own liquidity out of thin air, backed by their own productive capacity.
Exactly. And the result? Greco notes that this network experienced tempestuous, near-constant growth right in the middle of a crushing global depression.
That's incredible.
It was so successful that the WIR system still exists today, serving tens of thousands of Swiss businesses and clearing billions in trade.
It is absolute historical proof of concept that local communities can create their own functional currency based on real-world production.
Yeah, it works.
I love the WIR example, but here is my problem with it. The original WIR was a centralized manual ledger maintained by a specific group in Switzerland. It worked for a tight network. But we live in a massive, hyper-connected global economy. How do we take that concept of mutual credit and modernize it? How do we turn it into a digital currency that can be used everywhere without accidentally creating a new corporate monopoly or just a new Silicon Valley central bank?
This is where Greco provides his modern mechanical blueprint. He outlines an architecture called the Cooperative Factoring Exchange, or COFEX for short, and the creation of something called the XST token.
Okay, we need to walk through this very carefully, step by step, because this is the engine of the entire alternative system. And Greco bases this on a very common, slightly boring business practice called invoice factoring.
Yes. Traditional factoring is something businesses use every single day. Let's ground this in a real example. Imagine you run a small, local manufacturing business. You make custom metal parts.
Okay.
You just delivered a massive order, $50,000 worth of parts, to a large corporate client.
Yeah.
You give them an invoice. But standard corporate business terms dictate they have 60 or even 90 days to actually pay you.
But I have a problem. I have to pay my factory workers this Friday. I have to buy more steel next week. Yeah. I cannot wait 90 days for that cash.
Right.
So in the current system, what do? I go to a specialized financial company called a factor. I sell them that $50,000 invoice for immediate cash, but I have to take a painful discount.
Mm-hmm.
They might give me $47,000 today. Then in 90 days, the factor collects the full $50,000 from my corporate client, pocketing the $3,000 difference as profit.
Okay.
That is traditional factoring. It trades future verified revenue for immediate fiat liquidity at a cost. But the COFEX model introduces a massive paradigm shift. It flips the entire mechanism.
Oh, so.
Instead of a private profit-seeking bank buying your invoices with existing fiat cash, a local democratically run cooperative, the COFEX aggregates the unpaid invoices of many local small and medium businesses.
Okay.
And instead of handing out US dollars, the cooperative issues newly minted digital XT tokens directly to the producers. Okay, let's walk through the specific mathematical example provided in the text to make this concrete. We have three local businesses. We have Delta, a lumber supplier, Lambda, a software developer, and Omega, a catering company.
Right.
They all have verified unpaid invoices from their customers for work they have already completed. Delta is owed $33,000. Lambda is owed $23,000. Omega is owed $44,000.
If you add those up, they bring exactly $100,000 worth of verified invoices to the local COFEX cooperative.
Okay.
And the cooperative isn't just taking their word for it. They examine the invoices, confirm the goods and services were actually delivered, assess the creditworthiness of the buyers, and accept them.
So based on that $100,000 of real-world value that already exists in the world, COFEX mints 100,000 new digital XT tokens.
Exactly.
COFEX takes a small 1% fee, so 1,000 tokens, to cover administrative costs and build a default reserve pool. The remaining 99,000 tokens are distributed to the businesses based on their invoices.
Right.
Delta gets 32,670 XT. Lambda gets 22,770. Omega gets 43,560.
And here's where the economic magic happens. These businesses now have immediate liquidity. Delta uses their XT tokens to pay their raw material suppliers. Lambda pays its coders their weekly salaries in XT. Omega buys groceries for their catering business using XT.
The tokens begin to circulate locally.
Yeah, they act exactly like cash, flowing through the community, facilitating trade that otherwise might have stalled.
But it's not just printing money forever, like a central bank doing quantitative easing. There is a closed loop.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, the 60 or 90 days are up. The original customers who owed the money on those initial invoices have to pay their bills. They pay COFEX directly.
Right.
They can pay in fiat, or more importantly, they can acquire XT tokens currently circulating in the market and use those to settle the debt. And when those XT tokens return to COFEX to pay the invoice, they are extinguished, destroyed, erased from the ledger.
The cycle is entirely complete. The money was born from a promise of real value, it lived to facilitate local trade, and it died when the promise was fulfilled.
Wow.
It is honest money. It is anchored entirely to the real economy, completely bypassing the central banking system and its parasitic compounding interest.
Okay, stop right there. I have to push back on this because I hear the tokens are destroyed, and my immediate reaction is absolute panic.
Sure.
If the tokens are systematically extinguished, how on earth do people save money for the future? Don't humans naturally want and frankly need to hoard wealth for security? I want to save for my kids' college, for retirement. You can't just tell people they aren't allowed to hold on to their money.
It is the most common visceral objection to this model, and it requires a fundamental rewiring of how we view the purpose of currency.
Okay.
Greco argues that money, like the actual token itself, should only be a medium of exchange. Is merely a ticket to move goods. Think of it like a hot potato. It is emphatically not meant to be a long-term store of value.
A hot potato, so I'm supposed to get rid of it as fast as I get it? That sounds incredibly stressful.
It sounds stressful under the current paradigm, but the mechanics enforce it. To prevent the hoarding that destroys crypto, the XT token has what Greco calls a Goldilocks lifespan.
Which is what?
Typically 90 to 120 days, which perfectly matches the maturity of the underlying business invoices.
Okay.
But to ensure people don't try to stash these tokens under a digital mattress anyway, the system utilizes a powerful mechanism called demirage.
Demirage. Let's unpack exactly how that works, because this is wild.
Demirage is essentially a graduated holding fee. It actively penalizes hoarding.
Okay.
For example, the system might be programmed so that if you hold an XT token in your digital wallet for 6 months without spending it, it loses 10% of its face value. If you hold it to month 7, it loses 20%. Month 8, 30%. It slowly evaporates if it isn't actively circulating in the economy.
Wow. Okay, so people would be terrified of holding onto cash. It forces velocity. But I am still stuck on my savings. If my money melts, how do I build wealth?
The system forces you to change how you save. If you want to save for the future, you do not hoard the tickets. You take those tickets and you invest them immediately back into productive physical assets in your community. You buy a house. You invest in a local business expansion. You install solar panels that will generate real value electricity over the next 20 years. Demirage mathematically forces the economic surplus back into the real economy, continually stimulating local production and community resilience, rather than letting wealth stagnate in a billionaire's offshore bank account or a giant index fund.
It physically bakes the incentive to invest in your community into the very math of the money. That is profound.
It really is.
Okay, so we now have two highly detailed, fundamentally opposed structural models on the table. We have the brittle debt-based fiat system with its skyscraper rigidity.
Yeah.
And we have the production-anchored honest Kofex XT system with its hot potato demurrage.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pit them against each other. Let's run the ultimate stress test.
Yeah, we could apply Yanis Varoufakis' exact geopolitical disaster scenario to both systems to see how they behave. The Iran oil shock.
Right. Let's remind the listener of the fiat death spiral first.
Okay.
The Strait of Hormuz is blocked by conflict. The price of oil doubles overnight. In the fiat system, because the U.S. dollar is decoupled from real production, that energy spike instantly translates into massive systemic inflation.
And because the Federal Reserve's only tool to fight inflation is the interest rate lever, they are forced to aggressively spike rates.
Which crushes a global economy that is already drowning in compounding debt.
Exactly. Small businesses default on their loans, corporate bonds collapse, mortgages fail, and you trigger a massive destructive global recession.
Mm.
The skyscraper shatters.
Now let's look at the honest money system. Let's say a local economy is running primarily on Kofex and XT tokens. How does that community handle the exact same oil shock?
It handles it completely differently because the core architecture is different. In the Kofex system, XT tokens are anchored to a basket of real output, the actual goods and services the community produces, which inherently includes the embedded cost of energy.
Right.
So when the price of oil jumps, it is registered by the system merely as a relative price shift, not a systemic collapse of the currency's core value.
Let me puzzle this out. So a relative price shift means that just energy and things that require a lot of energy get more expensive compared to other things, whereas systemic inflation means the actual ruler we use to measure value shrinks, so everything goes up at once.
Exactly. With honest money, the measuring stick remains stable. Let's use a concrete example. Imagine a local logistics and delivery company running on XT tokens. Oil prices double. Their fuel costs skyrocket. They suddenly face massive margin compression. Their business model becomes instantly less profitable.
But, and I think this is the crucial difference, there is no central bank to panic and spike a universal interest rate on their underlying debt.
Precisely. Because Kofex credit is based on mutual claims, invoice factoring, and risk sharing, not fixed interest debt owed to a central hub, the losses are shared naturally.
Okay.
The logistics company might have to renegotiate terms, raise their specific delivery prices, or scale back operations. But they don't face a sudden 5% hike on a multi-million dollar loan that forces them into immediate bankruptcy.
They don't trigger a cascading wave of defaults that takes down the local baker and the software developer who rely on them.
No. The system doesn't break. Capital simply reallocates naturally and rationally. Investors and businesses look at the high cost of oil and say, okay, we need to invest our XT tokens into electric vehicles or more energy efficient local supply chains.
So the fiat system is built like a massive, rigid glass skyscraper, highly optimized, impressive to look at. But when a real geopolitical earthquake hits, that rigidity means it can't sway. It just shatters. The honest money system is like a structure built out of bamboo. It is incredibly flexible. When the wind howls or the earth shakes, it bends, it distributes the stress locally across its nodes. It might sway violently, margins might compress, it might be an uncomfortable year, but it doesn't shatter. It stays standing.
That's a great way to picture it.
But this bamboo structure, this COFEX network, sounds incredibly reliant on one very specific, very fragile thing. Trust.
Mm-hmm.
It relies entirely on localized networks of trust between SMEs and citizens. The baker has to trust the carpenter. The COFEX cooperative has to trust that the invoices are real.
Right.
How do you scale that kind of trust in a modern digital world across a city of millions of people who don't know each other without falling right back into the trap of a dystopian social credit score or surveillance capitalism?
That is the final crucial piece of the puzzle. An honest money system simply cannot function at scale without a transparent, verifiable, and equitable layer of civic trust. And to build that, the Source Stack turns to Frank Neusel's essay on democratizing civic data via a concept called ArtNet, which stands for Your Life is Your Art, and the organization of city-centered bioregions.
Neusel argues that data is essentially a civilization's nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, under the fiat and techno-feudal models, our data is extracted by massive tech monopolies. They scrape everything we do, use it for profit, for targeted advertising, and for behavioral control. We are the product, and they own the nervous system.
Neusel proposes a radical alternative. What if we treated local civic data as a public commons?
Interesting.
What if the data generated by a city belonged explicitly to the citizens of that city, governed at the local bioregional level, transparent and accessible to everyone?
Imagine cities no longer competing on abstract, highly gameable metrics like GDP or offering massive tax breaks to lure megacorporations just to create low-wage jobs.
Right.
Instead, they compete on visible, transparent metrics of actual human flourishing. Are we ecologically regenerating our local watershed? Are we reducing isolation among our elderly population? Are we actively building community trust?
And the sources synthesize all of these concepts, the data, the trust, the money, into what they outline as a unified four-layer operating system for a new civilization. This is where the entire stack integrates mechanically.
Let's break down those four layers, because this is the unified architecture that theoretically replaces the fiat empire. Layer one is truth.
Mm-hmm.
The sources call this strategic AI. But it's important to note, this isn't a generative chatbot writing poems. It's an analytical tool used by the community to identify actual physical bottlenecks in the real world supply chain issues, energy deficits, ecological damage, rather than relying on political spin or social media algorithms designed for outrage.
Right. It establishes a shared objective reality,
which is the absolute prerequisite for layer two, trust. This is managed by something called the Trust Mesh. The Trust Mesh is a decentralized digital network that computes actual social trust and reputation.
Okay, I know what you're going to say.
Computing social trust. That sounds terrifyingly close to a dystopian social credit score where if I jaywalk, I can't buy train tickets. How does this prevent becoming a popularity contest or an oppressive surveillance tool?
It's a vital distinction. A dystopian social credit score is top-down, punitive, and often based on political compliance. The Trust Mesh is designed to be bottom-up and based strictly on verified economic and civic delivery.
Okay.
It doesn't care about your political opinions. It calculates reliability based on verified human relationships. If you organize a park cleanup and people verify you did the work, or if your business consistently delivers high-quality goods on time to local buyers, your reputation on the Trust Mesh grows. It simply makes the invisible fabric of reliability visible.
It quantifies your track record of actually helping the community. Which brings us to layer three, claims. This is Greco's COFEX system and the XT tokens we just discussed.
Exactly, the honest money. But now it is integrated with the first two layers. The COFEX cooperative issues tokens to businesses whose reliability is mathematically verified by the community on the Trust Mesh, based on the objective reality identified by strategic AI.
The money is literally anchored in proven social trust and objective truth.
Yes.
And finally, layer four, civic action, empowering the community. Armed with a shared reality, visible trust, and honest, non-extractive money that doesn't bleed away to Wall Street, citizens can actually coordinate and solve local problems.
They don't have to beg a distant, gridlocked central government for fiat funding to fix a bridge or build a clinic. They can self-fund it through COFEX.
This four-layer operating system represents a profound structural civilizational shift. It is the transition from a growth-driven civilization to a development-driven civilization.
Let's really hammer home that distinction, because it feels like the philosophical core of everything we've talked about today. What is the difference between growth and development in this context?
So a growth-driven civilization is exactly what we have under the fiat regime, because fiat money is based entirely on debt that accrues compounding interest. The economy must constantly expand just to pay back the mathematically impossible interest.
Mm-hmm.
It requires infinite cancer-like expansion. It demands relentless resource extraction, constant mindless consumption, and, as Quigley pointed out, often imperial conquests to secure new markets and raw materials just to keep the debt bubble from popping.
But a development-driven civilization.
A development-driven civilization powered by non-usurious, honest money with a limited lifespan and demurrage doesn't have that mathematical imperative to endlessly consume.
Right. Without the gun of compounding interest to its head, society can focus on qualitative maturation. It can focus on ecological restoration, on distributive justice, on the arts, and on genuine human flourishing.
You don't have to build 10,000 cheap disposable chairs to pay the bank. You can build 1,000 beautiful, durable chairs that last a century.
It physically bakes peace and justice into the math of the money.
If nations don't have a structural, debt-driven mandate to endlessly expand their economies to avoid collapse, the imperial cycle of perpetual war that Quigley warned us about, it is finally broken. The invisible architecture no longer demands conflict.
The structural incentives for war are removed at the root level.
Let's take a breath and recap the immense journey we just took. We started by looking at the seemingly neutral money in your wallet, and we stripped away the illusion. We unpacked the weaponized architecture of the current fiat system, the swift panopticons, the choke points, the endless cycle of compounding debt and imperial conflict driven by network centrality.
And we examined Yanis Varoufakis's stark mechanical warning about the terminal vulnerabilities of this neoliberal model. We detailed exactly how a single geopolitical shock, like a disruption in the Strait of Hormuz, could trigger a catastrophic leverage cascade and the total collapse of the fiat empire into techno-feudalism.
And then we explored the escape hatch, a highly mechanical, historically grounded alternative where money is completely redefined. We looked at Greco's COFEX system, where money isn't a hoarded commodity, but an expiring ticket representing actual community trust and real-world production.
It constantly circulates, constantly renews, and actively discourages hoarding through demurrage.
We integrated that mechanical money with the concept of a democratized civic data commons, creating a unified architecture of truth, trust, claims, and action that fundamentally shifts us from destructive quantitative growth to meaningful qualitative development.
But we want to remind you as you go back to your day that the economy is not an unchangeable law of nature. It is a design choice.
And the tools to build a post-imperial, post-scarcity world don't require magic or sci-fi technology. They exist right now in the cooperative power of small businesses, transparent data stewardship, and local trust.
The architecture is conceptually sound and historically proven. The challenge is implementation, education, and overcoming the massive inertia of the vested interests who currently control the toll booth.
And that brings me to a final, slightly provocative thought to leave you with, something extrapolated from the very end of our source transcripts. We talked a lot about how this new system solves the macro problems of war, debt, and empire. But let's bring it back down to the micro level, to you. The psychology of living in this world.
The human impact of a structural shift.
Exactly. If we successfully build this world, if money physically cannot be hoarded because of demurrage, and your economic survival depends entirely on your visible, transparent community reputation on the trust mesh, what happens to human psychology? Do we simply replace our current grinding financial anxiety with a frantic, intense reputation anxiety? Will you be constantly terrified of making a social misstep in front of your neighbors because it might lower your trust mesh score and affect your ability to transact?
It's a deeply valid fear. A hyper-transparent, locally interdependent society could become oppressive and conformist in its own unique way if not carefully managed.
Or does removing the artificial scarcity, the constant predatory pressure of fiat inflation, and the fear of crushing debt finally allow us to breathe? Does it allow us to drop our defensive armor and settle into genuine, unguarded human connection, knowing that our community is structurally incentivized by the very math of the system to support us rather than exploit us?
It is the ultimate question of human nature. Who do we become when the structural pressures of extraction are finally removed?
It is. The next time you open your wallet, I hope you look at that currency a little differently. Keep questioning the invisible architecture around you. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.